Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
And we are recording. And I'm really happy to have back on the show Frederick Leroy, who's a professor at the Free University of Brussels in the field of food science and biotechnology. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
It's really great to have you on again. Last time we talked about various things, particularly focused on the so-called Eat Lancet initiative. The Lancet published an editorial about, you know, what is a healthy amount of red meat for both the planet and the individual. And, you know, we talked about that and human and planetary health, ruminants and the meat lobby, so-called. And it was a really interesting talk, and I'll link to it in the show notes so that people can listen back to it. But maybe for people who don't know who you are, or just as a way to set it up, can you talk about your background and what you've researched so far in your career?
Right. Okay. So I'm trained as a bioengineer, which in Belgium means that you're combining engineering skills, mathematics, process engineering, with biology. So it's engineering living matter, if you want, as opposed to engineering dead matter, as civil engineers do, so bridges and electricity. So you're focusing on living matter. And from there on, I went into food sciences, food processing, microbiology. And as a case study, I worked on animal foods, meat mostly, but also other things. I also worked on sourdough and dairy, but meat mostly. Until maybe, how long was that ago? Maybe let's say 5, 6, 7 years ago, I started to add an extra component to my research, which is interdisciplinary, because I was intrigued by the societal side of it. Now, why is meat so special to us? Because we talk a lot about meat very emotionally. You see, you mentioned Eat Lancet, where the main focus of the whole thing is on the meat. Now, because in the diet, they also suggest to heavily restrict your potato consumption, for instance, but nobody talks about that. No, it's all about meat in particular.
I didn't realize that Eat Lancet talks about restricting potatoes.
Yeah, well, it's starchy vegetables basically are not very favored by Willett, so it's rather limited as well. But as you see, nobody has ever really mentioned that quite a lot. Nobody really cares. You know, people will eat their potatoes if they want or not. It doesn't make any difference. But all the focus is on meat, because meat is so symbolically important to us that it. And I was. Even before Eat Lancet, you already saw the dynamic going up, especially after 2015, especially after the colon cancer report by IRC, WHO. And things were changing rapidly. So I just asked myself, why is that the case? What is happening here? Why are we just inverting every meaning we ever associated with meat? You know, all the positive things about meat, why are we inverting them all one by one? So. And that's remarkable. And it's happening so fast in a short window compared to our very long relationship with meat. You know, all the rich relationships we had with meat. I'm not even talking about millennia. I'm talking about probably a couple of million of years where meat started to be introduced in our diet and became not only substantial to evolution and to sustenance and to our biology, but also socially, it became a cornerstone. It became the center around which communities were organized very often. And suddenly all this is changing very rapidly. So this mere observation, which also happened to be my case study in my research, you know, I was just working on meat as a coincidence because I stepped into it because of a European project, basically, that was looking into meat fermentation. And I ended up looking at the microbes in meat. And then, you know, I started to ask myself, what about this topic that I'm looking at also? This is not just an abstract matrix of nutrients. It's something more than that. So I wanted to find out, and I started my interdisciplinary research connections with the humanities. And over the years, I worked with all kinds of different people, you know, anthropologists, historians, psychologists, veterinarian scientists, anything, like many different people with different skills. And I, you know, wanted to sketch that broader picture within society. What does it mean for us, and how is our relationship, and how is it evolving, especially?
Yeah, okay, great. That's a nice summary. And we can link in the show notes to your Twitter as well, but that's a great place to start, I think, for finding out, you know, what you kind of like to share about your research and talk about. Recently, there was a cover of Time magazine that you shared that said The Great Reset, and it had a picture of the globe with some scaffolding and people kind of looking like they were segmenting the earth up and working on it and engineering it somehow. So can you talk us through your understanding of what the Great Reset means? And, you know, in the context of, you know, hashtags that you've used that's linked to this, like the Great Food Transformation, the Planetary Health Diet, and the Eat Lancet Commission.
Yes, it's the Great Reset is it's a huge, wide and invasive concept that I cannot pin down to small conversation here. It's something that is substantial. It's also, I would say that 90%, I have absolutely no clue about 90% of its contents, because it's all about ICT and it's about fourth industrial revolution. It's about blockchain and who knows what. It's about changing the way that the planet is supposed to operate. But there is a fraction in that Great Reset, which is about our diets as well. And that's the one where I know most about, and that I also started to explore. And it's the one that I've been exploring since a couple of years. And suddenly I see the same actors that I've been seeing during those years that are trying to change our diets operating within the same space of the Great Reset. It's all the same actors that are trying to change the way our clothes, our houses, our cars, anything that we want in our daily lives. Those same people that are trying to reset all that, or whatever that means, or transform all that, they also want to transform our diets. It's the same people, it's the same organizations. And that's, again, remarkable. And as I mentioned before, things are accelerating, things are changing very, very fast. And this is like somebody is pressing a boost button somewhere to make it even go faster. So to tackle this topic is going to be a bit tricky. I think you will have to try to get me on track here, because it's very easy to get lost in the different plot lines.
Okay.
Well, why it also sounds very much like a conspiracy theory, basically, and it's also
I was going to say is, why don't you start with these people who are number one part of the Great Reset and the Eat Lancet Commission that you've already recognised. And two, it's a matter of public record. So it's not like, and I mean, we're talking about the cover of Time magazine here. We're not talking about, a weird document on 4chan. It's mainstream. It's public to some extent. There's lots of money behind it. So maybe you could just outline some of the mutual figures between the Great Reset and the Lancet Commission.
Okay. Yes, it gets polluted by all kinds of conspiracy ideas. That's the problem. So people start to frame it in all kinds of different ways. And it is a very radical thing. So it easily overwhelms us. So we don't tend to take it seriously to begin with. But as you say, it has been on Time magazine. So it's something that is actually taking place. We also don't really know how much of that is propaganda and marketing and how much is substantial transformation. It's deploying itself. So we don't really know where this is going. But as far as I see it, it is not a reset as such, because if you look at the players and the actors within that network, they're not resetting anything. They're just accelerating a business model that has been in place since decades. And they are more trying to lift it to a higher level, to make it bigger, faster, and more efficient in what they're doing. The idea is, it has several ideas, but and also have to talk about the different actors within that network. But the idea is to center the global economy around private-public partnerships, right? It's a conglomerate of different transnational corporations, big companies, finance centers, and non-governmental organizations. And that network has been created, that idea at least has been created especially in the early 90s, but it comes from before that, but in the early 90s, with the summit in Rio, of the United Nations, 92, the Earth Summit, as they call it, that's the stage where these things have first been deployed, the idea of, you know, combined. So basically, neutralizing environmental NGOs and the green movement, taking them within that large cluster, linking it to corporate models, and trying to connect governments to that, and trying to impose agendas top down. And that's what's happening today. All this talk about changing our way of life is not the traditional conventional democratic process. It's something that trickles down from a level that is somewhere above the national level. And it trickles down, and we don't see it happening in our daily voting systems or in our daily democracies. It's coming from a higher level. And it changes through that system the way policies are deployed internationally. So it overrules basically a lot of national democratic consciousness, if you want. So who's there? Well, you have, of course, the World Economic Forum is the place where things come together. So the World Economic Forum is normally organized in Davos, Switzerland, but this year they've changed to another location for the Great Reset. And it's where you find the world elites, basically. So all the elites go there. You have everybody that is meaningful in politics and in finance and in business is going to be in the World Economic Forum. It's a platform that goes back several decades. And it's very closely linked to certain fractions within the United Nations, which gives them a certain appeal, right? So it's they try to connect their agendas to the Sustainable Development Goals, which are targets that they are putting forward to justify what they're doing, which in essence is a lot of greenwashing. It's a lot of framing of destructive practices and presenting them as green and as sustainable. It distracts us from what's really damaging the planet in the first place. And it just presents false solutions. That's generally speaking. But there's also a diet. So it's all about also transitions. They talk a lot about transitions. There's a certain also new age component in the whole thing, which is very weird. And it's going back to the origins, because in 92, Maurice Strong, which was the one that set up the conference, he was very heavily into New Age. So there's a certain mindset there of, I'm not saying that what's happening today is a New Age cult or something, but in the mindset, you have the influence of that thinking in transitions, that moving to a new planetary consciousness, or however they want to present it. So there is also a utopian component to it. So there's clearly a financial component. You have these mega corporations, they're just looking for a new business model. We can talk about what that means for the diet, for instance. I cannot talk so much about the other things, but for the diet, we can talk about what it means as a business model. So there's this business component, but there's also this utopian component, which attracts all the NGOs and basically neutralizes them. And that comes from its beginnings, this idea that we have to lift this planet to a higher level and make it conscious and bring it to some kind of omega point where everything becomes a singularity, basically. You find the weirdest ideas in those historical beginnings of the whole movement.
It's funny, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Billions. It's about billionaires and what they get up to in order to get what they want. Now, they come from all sorts of backgrounds. Some billionaires were born into it. Some are self-made. But usually they're very clever. If they made their fortunes themselves, they're usually very ruthless. And they're usually very charming in a way. And most people, them included, don't want to either feel like or look like bad people. And in my mind, there's parallels to be drawn here, because I'm sure a lot of these actors that you're talking about are billionaires or, you know, multi-millionaires who, number one, want to keep making money, number two, want to look good, and number three, want to feel good. So it makes sense that they would couch this kind of grand scale control of business practices and co-opting of governments and NGOs and other businesses as, you know, really purely a good thing for the planet. It makes sense in terms of the PR and themselves feeling good as people.
Yeah, it's within their psychology, I think, and it's probably not all of them, but many of them are actually convinced that they're doing the right thing. And it's this cocktail, you know, of ideology about transitioning society to another level, together with the business model next to that. It's, as you say, it's maybe a logical outcome of the whole setup of things. You know, you have these elites that are feeling that they're in charge, and they, of course, want to keep on doing what they're doing. And they're so disconnected from everyday reality that they just don't get it. I think that this what they're doing is not in tune with what the rest of society is having in mind. So this is thing, I think, what we're seeing. It's also, of course, there are also many other aspects that we could talk about, but I'm less familiar with. But what we do see is that there are institutions in there, such as the World Resources Institute, that are basically, if you look at their board of directors, they're basically ruled by things like the Council for Relations, or the World Economic Forum is represented there as well. You have all kinds of big banks. So there's also a strategic component in there about how we're going to organize macroeconomically what is happening on this planet, and pushing the buttons there to direct it in the ways that they want to see go forward. So it's always the most dangerous thing in history, probably, when you combine ideology with profit, that's or power for that matter. That's when things get usually dangerous.
Yeah, so we've got this overall view now of a certain group of very wealthy people who are in positions of control in different industries and disciplines. And I suppose, like you say, it's too large a topic to properly describe everything in detail. So let's narrow in on food and where you think things are with you know, the Great Reset and the Great Food Transformation. Now, as compared to when we talked about Eat Lancet before.
Yeah, so what you find in the more general part is that they talk about transitions. They talk about great transitions. They talk about transforming, right? And this vocabulary comes back in the food part as well. They talk about the great food transformation. That's how EAT describes itself. EAT, by the way, also describes itself as a Davos for food. They have literally said that we are a Davos for food. And whatever they're doing is promoted by the World Economic Forum. I mean, you clearly see, in based on many elements, I detail them in my tweets if people want to look at it. But there, in many elements, you can see that this EAT, great food transformation, and the moving to a planetary health diet, because that's also what they're claiming, a planetary health diet, that's really part of the transition mindset that is part of the Great Reset. It's the same idea. It's the same vocabulary. It's the same players. You find the same people that you will find in the other fields. You will find, again, the World Resources Institute. You will find the United Nations Environmental Program. You will find WWF. You will find the World Bank. I could go on, but all those people, you will also find them in the other fields. It's about resources and controlling resources. It is about managing the resources for the rest of us. So they basically decided we're gonna manage the planetary resources because we are the best ones to do so. That's happening in the dietary part. So they want to transition towards that controlled diet, basically, that they call planetary. So it's unifying the diets of this enormous variability that we have in human diets is basically being condensed to a monolithic concept of a planetary health diet. And that's what they're doing with all the other things as well. They're talking about, you have this movement that tries to find a single religious angle to cover all the other religions. That's also within, United Nations spheres. You have city concepts that have to be, global. You find all kinds of global governance ideas where they try to have a model and to impose that model on a planetary basis. And the same for the diet, so they call it planetary health diet. And in the documents and in their PR, they always say, oh, respect variability, respect cultural differences. But in the end, you have this very narrow window where you can operate it, which has almost no animal foods, which is dominated by grains and oil. And it's a very radical diet, basically. It looks a lot like the macrobiotic diet. If you look at the macrobiotic diet, as we knew it in, it's not so popular anymore, but a couple of decades ago in the 80s, 90s, you had macrobiotic dieting, and that was very much the same. It's restricting red meat as much as you can. It's not having too many eggs. It's mostly beans and whole grains. It's the potatoes, again, were not very much wanted in the macrobiotic diet, but that's probably a coincidence. The overall setup is very much the same. And we know that macrobiotic diet created a lot of damage, by the way. We know that from studies. There's information from the Netherlands that, for instance, that children were hit by deficiencies on that diet. And it's a diet that looks a lot like the planetary health diet. I'm not saying that nobody can live on that diet and the diet cannot be suitable for anybody. I mean, if you do it well and if you think about it and if you nicely supplement things and you combine your foods in a proper way, maybe you can get there and have good health. Maybe not everybody, but the point is that it is a much less robust diet than traditional diets that have evolved over centuries, locally, culturally, and connect people. People are connected to the practices, they know what to do, they know how to prepare them. And suddenly you have this model that is supposed to replace everything, and you can vary in between it. But it's so funny if you look at it. For instance, they have this planetary health shopping list that they presented on the website. So EAT has presented this shopping list, and if you look at the shopping list, it's so urban hipster as you cannot imagine it. They talk about the usual things: sushi sheets or the seaweed sheets to make sushi. You have to buy tahini, you have to buy avocados, you have to buy all those kinds of foods. That's the way they present it, because it appeals to urban Western consumers that are looking for to virtue signal with their diets, that they're looking for an option to be morally superior by sticking to a certain dietary model. But it ignores every background of proper human commensal community kind of eating and food traditions. It just overrules all that.
Yeah, so we had Alison van Enenum on the podcast, who she's at BioBeef on Twitter. She's great. You know, she made the point, if we're to stop animal agriculture, then we suddenly remove the livelihood and source of food for about a billion people who are in poverty around the world. Is that what urban hipsters want? I mean, the only people who can afford to give up some meat that they have and supplement and you know, fall back on the health service if they get ill are people in rich countries. And they form a much smaller part of the global total of people. So there's something not quite right about the recommendation versus the reality. Now, what do you think about that? Do you think that it's, I mean, obviously, you know, there's no point in speculating about people's motives too much because we can't know that. But from the data that you've seen, what do you think is really going to happen, you know, in the plan? Is it about convincing people to reduce demand for certain things, or is it about ultimately using governmental force or laws to impose particular growing patterns, or, you know, removing livestock from the land? I mean, what are we talking about here?
Mm-hmm. Maybe first a small comment on your first sentences, where you were talking about low-income countries or middle-income countries. They're very... So when the EAT report was launched, there was a response from Ethiopia, from a minister of Ethiopia, I think of agriculture, protesting against the fact that, you know, livestock is essential to a country like Ethiopia, and inviting them to come and look, go and look what's happening in our country. This is something vital to our livelihoods and the way we live and the way we nourish ourselves. And you have this strange ambiguities in their PR as well, where they say that, well, animal foods are important, and especially important in lower middle income countries, and we have to look at the West. So they admit that from time to time. But then in other communications, they're so radical about what they want to achieve. And again, you have this global planetary health that eventually will have to cover also the other countries. So there was a recent report from EAT where they presented two countries as a model for the planet, basically, because it was the only countries that fit into their boundary idea were India and Indonesia. So they have this romanticism about India and Indonesia as being a perfect model for future eating for the rest of the planet. Because we have this Western romantic idea about Indian diets being based on, you know, vegetarianism. But by doing so, they completely overlook that in India, you still have today a lot of malnutrition as well. And that if you just take away the animal foods, you're taking away the most robust source of nutrition. So, well, it's all about contextuality. You know, every country will have its own nutritional traditions and its own way of building a food supply system and food security. In some countries it's not going very well and they need a little boost there, but it's this uniform idea that really bothers me, the way that they want to have a uniform solution and based on a very narrow vision on nutrition, which basically comes from Harvard, and it has to be imposed planetary. So of course they do realize that it will not be accepted. They understand that it's in their document, it's in the EAT-Lancet report. They literally say that they know that consumers will not like this. They even speak of the whim of consumer choice, you know, that it's something almost like dietary choice and dietary freedom is almost something bad. Right? They will not accept it because they're too egoistic, or so they will not accept our model. And they understand that. So they, in the same document, they also argue for what they call hard policy interventions. So So they're talking about hard policy interventions, not the soft ones, not the ones where they would say, look, it's better to eat this way, you have to eat less meat. No, it's about hard policy interventions because they know that people will not accept that. So what does that mean? There's a whole spectrum that they can use. And there's a spectrum that has been designed by their very close partner, which is the World Resources Institute. And they have come up with something based on what they call the shift wheel, which is apparently is a technique that is used already in nudging and in marketing. And based on that, they have presented some solutions to work on. So it involves things like taxes, restrictions and bans from certain public canteens, promoting things like veganuary or something, like monthly challenges. It's a lot of nudging, of course. It's messing with retail setup. So in supermarkets, that you should put the meat part on the less visible place and you should emphasize more the vegan alternatives. It's about interfering with dietary guidelines. They already had considerable influence over the Canadian guidelines, for instance. And in Denmark also, they had quite a bit of influence on dietary communication and advice. So there's a spectrum from the soft ones, which are more how you present your alternative, so people will eat less meat or less dairy or anything else, towards really banning it or taxing it very severely so that people will not be able to buy it anymore or will choose to buy something else. So there's a spectrum, and they want to mobilize that spectrum to overrule dietary choice within a society, which is pretty totalitarian, and it fits within that idea of transitioning. You know, everybody has a transition together. They all have to transition according to the great plan, the great food transformation.
It's very similar in rhetoric to Chairman Mao's Great Leap Forward, which didn't go very well and caused a lot of food problems.
It's what you get when you have people that go top-down, authoritarian, deciding for the rest of us what they think is the best thing to do. And that may be an honest feeling, or that may not be an honest feeling, but most cases this goes wrong because it completely neglects what is happening at the bottom of society where people actually live. And that you cannot just do that. You cannot just force people in a certain direction and just hope that everything goes well. This is asking for trouble. If it really goes in to the point of really restricting food choice, if that will be the outcome, so we'll have to see what happens, but if this will be the outcome, and there are some signs that they really want to favor a restriction, if that will be the outcome, I think that we will run into serious problems.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, on a small scale, in the old days, when nobody was moving from really one place to another, talking a few hundred years ago, probably the Lord would have complete control over the food. You know, if you got caught taking a deer or a rabbits or something, then you would probably get killed. I guess food control is money, business, power, ideology all rolled into one, and it's no surprise that a group of people who want to continue to make money and feel like they're doing the right thing would look at food. I mean,
yeah.
Have you spoken to anyone who's in these organizations?
Within EAT, I had some contacts, I had some email exchanges, or I had some, yes, but nothing substantial. They're not really interested in lots of dialogue, I think, either. They want to go ahead with what they're doing. And you know that they're really having access to the policy buttons. That's the thing. What's coming up next year is a huge food summit, United Nations Food Summit. Food Systems Summit, and this summit has five tracks, I think, or four or five tracks. One of the tracks is on sustainable diets, and it is chaired by the founder of EAT, Gunhild Stordalen. She chairs it. And the anchoring agency that is under her package is the World Health Organization. So that's going to happen in the year of the Great Reset. So you can be sure that it will try to go even faster at that point. What you mentioned also before, historically, it reminds me a lot of this book by James Scott, Against the Grain, which is a great book, by the way. And it shows how when people transitioned into settled communities, how that new system very rapidly in historical terms, how that evolved to be depending on grain, especially. So grain was really the way they controlled the food system, because that was the best way to do it. And it was a way to tax people. It was much more difficult for them to organize a system around underground tubers or something, so it needed to be something that you can watch, that you can control, that you can harvest in specific points of the year so nobody can cheat. So you can send your tax man and demand your taxes at a certain moment of time. And then so he describes very well in his book how grain was really the way that the first elites gained control over the lower classes. By focusing a food supply system on grain, that's the way they achieve their power.
It's very interesting using Sapiens, the where Yuval Harari book, where he says it's interesting. He's a ideological vegan on kind of minimizing suffering grounds, which I don't particularly follow myself. It's like Nick Mailer says, if you really want to reduce suffering the most, then just let off all the nuclear warheads and kill everyone on the planet, and kill everything on the planet, then nothing will suffer again. I don't think it really follows, but that's a side note. He kind of notes that it's a mystery. It's a bit of a mystery. Why did we stop hunting big game, where you know we could reliably get nutritious calories in a one-stop shop, and exchange that for back-breaking work for substandard food that could fail if there was a drought or too much rain. And I think your point explains quite a lot of that.
Yeah, it certainly explains part of the story. I mean, there are many other things involved. It had to do with ecosystem changes. It had to do with all kinds of other things. But certainly it helped to develop that first system of based on tax control, cities, elites, and then we had a very long time of oppression after that. By the way, the same author, James Scott, also wrote a fantastic book called Seeing Like a State, I think it's called. And it perfectly describes what the problem is with everything that is a monolithic top-down kind of approach on a complex field. So he's not talking about food specifically, even though he addresses some parts of the food system as well. But generally speaking, also urbanization, for instance, where he talks about Brasilia in Brazil. You know, when you have these cities that are imposed to be functional, to be measurable, so that you can control what's going on, you can measure what's going on. So basically, you need registration. So if you want to control a population, you need to be able to measure. And all those top-down kind of things are based on accountancy. The whole Eat Lancet thing is based on accountancy. It's based on metrics and how you use those metrics to get control over things. So you want it within certain windows. You want it within the so-called planetary boundaries. That's where you want to keep your system in. So you want to control it. And if you want to control it, you have to measure it. You have to make it visually understandable. That's why it always comes with neat visual things. You know, you have this planetary diet, you have this planetary boundary system with, you know, colors and easy diagrams. That's something you always see. Very simple, very algorithmic or very, how to put it, geometric kind of approaches to complex ideas. So you simplify the enormous complexity of human diets to a single model, which is a circle and a couple of lines and colors in it. You simplify the enormous complexity of environmental sustainability to this, again, circle model with colors in it and a couple of lines. And that's how you want to think. You want to think in a simplified way, based on a very simple design, and impose that design on a whole field, on the universe, basically. So those two books, I think, of James Scott are really essential reading if one wants to understand what is going on today. They're very inspirational. They're absolutely great analysis of authoritarian systems that want to achieve control.
We were talking before we started recording about how much information we have now. And, you know, the principle of the Hydra, this multi-headed snake, that if you cut a head off, three more will appear, and that the internet kind of prides itself on acting like that. And I guess thinking about Chairman Mao with the Great Leap Forward, or going further back, the control of grain for warlords to impose their will, and going further back still, probably, you know, I mean, you see wolves leaving the liver for the alpha male after a kill, that kind of thing. You know, food and imposing will is there, and you've been able to piece together this from a lot of information which is actually publicly available. Now, do you think that that makes it easier to understand and combat? I mean, money talks, so like you say, much of this is likely to happen, but how do you think it'll be different in the modern age, if at all?
The difference probably with many things have changed. If you look back 10, 15, 20 years, you can say that a lot has changed. A lot has changed because, first of all, what you get as official news is much more narrow than before. Even though we have many more communication channels and many more newspapers, still investigative journalism is almost dead in mainstream media. It's all narrowed down to Reuters and the main messages that are really centralized and feeding you very specific information that is just not, is according to the mainstream ideas, and that's what you'll get. If you open the newspaper, you had different journalists with different opinions. You could find your own opinion in between the noise of those different voices, and you started to think for yourself and you made your opinion. Now it's very difficult to do so based on what you get from media. But on the other hand, you have this bottom-up movement that is coming from social media. It's coming from people interconnecting through very specific, sometimes, platforms. And you have communities that are building. And those communities start to think for themselves based on another great thing that happened, I think, is the access to scientific information. I know we have to be careful about, you know, giving detailed information to a public that has not been trained to interpret it in the correct way. That always comes with danger. But on the other hand, it also helps to make it accessible to people that are intelligent enough to understand what's going on, and sometimes start to understand that what is presented as scientific consensus is not necessarily a true consensus, but it is just the mainstream version of a scientific debate. And then you can only start seeing that if you really have access to things like PubMed, and you see there are different, actually, studies available. You have to read the whole paper, not just the abstract. And then you start understanding that it's much more complex than what they are telling you in the newspapers. And that's for every field, basically. It's, of course, mostly valid for the most controversial ones, and food is certainly among them, and, you know, health, nutrition. But that's the difference also, that people are that have the interests and skills intellectually to dig into those things, that they do this and open it up to the public in their groups, in their communities. You get an information stream that is going from the very specialized literature to the larger public, and that counter reacts on, you know, what is given by the conventional media. Because the conventional media are just giving you a mess completely. We've done this study also in the early years when I started to try to understand why things are changing. I did a discourse analysis of what was presented in the Daily Mail. And so I looked at what people were seeing in the Daily Mail, specifically for meat and health. And you had this nonsensical information where you had in the same newspaper, you will have one article. One I remember well is the one, well, for instance, you had many articles that are saying that if you eat meat, you become less fertile and you have less children and sperm quality goes down. And then you have in the same newspaper, you have the other side as well. So it was conflicting information. And what I saw was that the way it was presented was getting worse year after year. You could see that in kind of in parameters that you could follow up. And so the messages became more sensationalist, more uniform, less complexity, and they were clashing in between them. And you have two sides, and then one side becomes more important. So the meat is bad kind of side then eventually will take over. But this is a dynamic that is not informative. It's not helping. There's no point anymore in reading those newspapers because you just don't get information anymore.
I've found that with storylines, talking to people that I know around COVID, and we don't need to talk about COVID at all. But I think it's a perfect example of how very quickly, not just the news sources themselves, but the people who tend to read them, drew up battle lines and said, you know, I'm a Guardian person or I'm a Telegraph person. And if someone who you thought was a Guardian person shared something from the Telegraph, then all of a sudden they want old people to die. Or if someone who normally reads the Telegraph reads the Guardian, then they've lost their minds or something. And it's become a flag rather than, like you say, a storyline rather than a source of information that people can assess, and it's become a cartoon.
Yeah, yes. And that's toxic, I think. It's toxic because when a society realizes that its official sources of information are not doing what they're supposed to do, that's very harmful because it erodes your confidence you're having in the normal societal functioning. So you project it easily on the politicians, and you start to have distrust of everything. If the information you're getting is clearly not in place or is clearly not the way it's supposed to be, then your counter reaction will be to say that, well, I shouldn't trust anything, any of those. And then you become suspicious, and it may end up in all kinds of different corners, and people get lost in that. They try to find a new way of making sense, for the better or worse. You know, you may slide down a conspiracy hill, or you may indeed find a constructive community that just gives you a new direction and gives you indeed sense as you want it. So it for sure does things with people, the way that mainstream information now reaches us. It's clear that that changes completely the paradigm compared to, let's say, 15 years ago. That has changed, and its information is now different. It's individualized, and I think the only way out of all this mess is that we have to use this information to positively engage communities and build up bottom up really for as good as everything, but especially also for the food system. So people get organized around communities around in actual information, around people putting that information to practice. And that can be catalyzing a positive evolution. Because if we have to wait from what is coming top down on our heads in that very narrow window of specific narratives, then we'll all be lost. We have to counter that bottom up by communities based on actual evidence and on actual practice, people that have felt things, that have tried things, that know about things, that have tried them out, that communicate their failures, that communicate what they gained to each other, and start from there. That's the only way out of this.
And it's really interesting when I'm looking at this kind of partisan us versus them, very deep mentality in all of these phenomena that you're talking about, whether it's the media or the person next door. I'm noticing, I like seeing when people find things in common, because that, I think, is what you're talking about, is this bottom-up community approach. And, you know, you have films like The Magic Pill, or which has kind of been held up in the last couple of years as a really good example of how meat eating can be good for people and the planet, you know, about regenerative agriculture. Or and a point of kind of agreement might be from a more plant-based direction is the film Kiss the Ground, which came out recently on Netflix, where we have a vegan of 30 years, Woody Harrelson, narrating basically that it's not the cow, it's the how, and that regenerative agriculture is the community tool for understanding and making food which is good for us and the planet. And I don't know if I'm being astroturfed, as they say, where, you know, this information has been planted somehow to make me feel better, or whether there's any real hope in this kind of grassroots regenerative agriculture movement. But to me, that is the hope. I don't know how you feel about, you know, if you see any coming together of different groups in a positive way, and what you think about the whole regenerative agriculture thing.
Well, it certainly is a way of whether it will succeed or not to modify the food supply system and substantially deliver what it has to deliver is something that we have to see evolving in the future. But what it certainly does is that it makes us look again at what is absolutely crucial here, and that's the healthiness of things. It's the healthiness of the soil, it's the healthiness of the animals, it's the healthiness of the foods that come of those animals, it's the healthiness of the communities that are taking those foods and nourishing themselves with those foods. And it's about the society that comes from those people. So it's the absolute bottom-up kind of approach. It's really starting from grassroots. it's building up from below, and it's focusing on ground level. And you have to construct this thing starting on a solid basis. If you start making a food supply system that, as it's now in the Great Reset kind of model, that is basically part of the idea is to start also producing things in labs. And you know what will happen if you produce things in labs? First of all, they start from cheap resources. They start from all kinds of extracts and starches and who knows what to mimic complex foods. That happens in the lab. It will be controlled. Even if it's maybe a small spin-off in the beginning, it will very rapidly be controlled by multinational corporations. It will undermine food security. It will make it very fragile. You know, you need a crisis to understand how fragile a Western food system can be if it's depending on that kind of actors. If you want to build in resilience, you will have to do it in close connection to healthy foundations. And the foundation of all foundations is the ground, is the soil. So that's your absolute focus. And indeed, maybe we shouldn't think also all that much about animals versus plants. It's the wrong discussion we're having. We should think about getting those animals and those plants in an integrated, holistic approach where they benefit from each other and where they deliver the foods that we actually need. and that can nourish us, not feed us with calories or not feed us with grams of proteins, but that can actually nourish us nutritionally, but also culturally and socially, that it brings us back around that table. And that would only happen, people will only get back to commensal eating and rich interactions around the table if they get back to the soil part. Maybe not by putting their hands in the soil and start digging, but by understanding that it starts from there, by witnessing how that works and how the farmer works, by seeing how he works, by understanding what he does. And if that discussion is going on, that's the only hope we're having of bringing people back again to their food and getting them really attached to the food network, rather than seeing it as a commodity, as something that you buy in a supermarket, that you put in the microwave, put in your plate, you eat it, and your partner comes half an hour later, puts it in the microwave as well, and you hardly eat together. You know, that's the dynamic we're seeing now very often. It's very individualized. It's based on a product that you're supposed to eat, otherwise you're hungry. This is not what food should look like. And that's where I see regenerative agriculture stepping in, because it's a way of it helps to understand. It's more than a production system. It's a mindset. It helps us to understand how food is produced and how that is part of a network and of of a cyclus, and how that is something that is not just a linear thing that comes from the shop right to your stomach. So it has its advantages, I think, first of all, which are tangible and which have to do with carbon sequestration and soil health and improving water retention and limiting the runoff into waterways and all sorts of things that are beneficial for ecosystems. But it also has the more human dimension involved, which I think is very important, and that's what you need to build your community. Now, to which degree that will be able to deliver enough food are complex questions. I have no ready answer to that, and probably what needs to happen is a mosaic of things, is trying different methods, trying different approaches, and eventually we'll learn from that and we'll move to the one that is most appropriate, and that will start dominating. But the problem is that we cannot really do that this moment, because things are trapped into local, they're trapped into specific subsets of solution that are having very high barriers. So you cannot just wash them away, because they're so much entrenched in the way we organize the food system that it's not easy to compete with those. But there are ways around it if you give it enough weight, and that means if you get enough people behind it. So the only way to counter the big dominating system of food as we know it today is by having enough people behind it to counter it. And how you set the thing in motion, I don't know, but I feel that something is going on. I feel that people start to organize themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, my long-term goal is to be involved with a regenerative farm, which is just a figment of my imagination right now, but or maybe it exists already, I'm not sure, but I want to get involved and either make it a charitable organization or a social enterprise or something. But I love the film Biggest Little Farm, and I can see the appeal of being involved in a place where it's successful as a farm, but also where young people, old people, anyone in between actually can come and stay and and live there and work there and enjoy it and see what it is to make food. And I think that could be a really positive, transformative experience for people. And I think it could become very popular actually. I've got a feeling that because we're so divorced from it in the last 50 years, that the pendulum will swing back because it's a very deep urge to understand where our food comes from.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. It's just, I'm just hoping that they will not destroy too much on the way until we get there, because the policies that are now being implemented are destructive. And I'm most afraid, I think my biggest fear of all, is that what we're doing now is driving farmers out of business, not necessarily economically, but mentally. We have suicides within farming communities, which are horrendous. They're absolutely horrendous. Farmers are just completely depressed at times, understandably so. They're vilified, you know, they're doing hard work, they're providing our foods, and then, you know, you get vilified on top of that, and you have very hard policy interventions, you have a difficult life as a farmer, and the result is that a farmer will not advise sons or daughters to continue the business anymore, and those sons and daughters clearly see that it's not something that is a very joyful life at the moment. It can be very rewarding, you know, but you have to deal with it. It's not an easy task. So if this happens, if we really discourage new generations of stepping into farming, then what will happen? Then there will be no other way than coming up with those lab foods, because the rest will just not be feasible anymore. We will not be able to supply enough. So that's my biggest fear, that by the time that people start getting back, because I'm absolutely convinced that eventually farming would have its second breath and start again to flourish at some point in time, and people understand that is absolutely needed. But will we be able to do so when these policies will be implemented? They're talking about, you know, protected areas and so on, where they will just remove farming land, drive people out of farming land and make that protected areas. Skills will get lost. Or those can be recovered, but anyway, the grip of the powers that be over the food supply system will be even larger. So they will not allow any new entries. It will be an uphill struggle if they further erode what is going, if they further amplify what is going on now, which means the degradation of farming as we know it, the undermining of farming as we know it, then I think we'll be in trouble. So I'm hopeful that people will indeed reconnect to food, because in the end, it's our basic need. It's one of the very, very basic needs. We cannot just ignore that. I often work with this model based on the pyramid of Maslow. Mm-hmm. Abraham Maslow, he developed the pyramid of human needs. I like that model because it's a nice framework to work in. So you have this, in the model of Maslow, what you have is your primary need at the bottom, that is your physiology, and that's eating, of course. That's you need, everybody needs that, and even, you know, non-human animals also need that. That's the basis. Everything needs food. And then on top of that, you have food security. The next need is that you really want to feel at ease, that you don't have to struggle for that nutrition. That's your next need. And then you get the need of community. The communities are what you need to be able to crystallize that food security in the first place. And it's also where food starts, that's very human. That's when food starts to get its social meaning, its cultural meaning. It's the center of communities. It forges communities. It makes communities. And then after that, you will have the typical Western levels where people are, you know, having their basic needs covered, and you get the next need of status. Now that's a human universal need. You find that everywhere as well, but it's amplified in the West, in the middle classes especially. And then even on top of that, you have the one of self-actualization. That can be anything from the spiritual to whatever. That's when you're really comfortable with all the other things. Now, I'm saying this also because we've seen it with the COVID crisis, is that this pyramid, as Maslow described it, basically has been put upside down. Everything that we, the West has put it upside down. The Western society has put the model upside down. It's the COVID crisis that reminded us of this strange shift here. Because we constructed now a Maslow pyramid model where the tip at the bottom is holding everything. And we take all those layers below for granted. We take for granted that we'll find the food, that it will be in the supermarket, on the supermarket shelves. We take for granted that we're part of a community, and we focus on the status and the self-actualization. But at some point, COVID came in and gave it a kick, and that wobbly model that was upside down starts to suffer from it, because you saw how people run to supermarkets, how the shelves were, you know, were invaded, and people were buying meat, and they were buying robust nutrition. They were not going for the frivolous stuff. They were buying meats, went up, dairy. So people were looking for zinc, for vitamin D, for, you know, those things that strengthen us. They were looking also for, so they were looking for nutrition, they were looking for food security, they were hamstering, and they were looking also for communities again, because, you know, they were, you were locked on the lockdown, you had, you were in need to see people, and they forgot a lot about what was going on the top of the pyramid for a moment. So, and that's the message that we have to take with us, I think, that if we're gonna great reset everything, basically it doesn't mean any reset at all. It means that we're gonna consolidate the inverted pyramid. And that sooner or later will crash.
Well, actually, I hope it does, and I hope it does it sooner rather than later. I think that's a good point to stop on, because it's, I think it's hopeful. You know, I think it might be naive of any organization to think that their goals can be achieved top down in the long term, whether that's fascist, where you're trying to join, you know, state and business together, or whether it's communist, or whether it's, you know, some kind of tin pot dictator, whatever it is. And there's got to be hope in the power of community to have a grassroots effect, even if there's damage in between now and then, even if we need the damage to make us see that there's a problem in the first place. So where can people find you and follow what you're saying?
Well, I have my Twitter account, basically, where I'm pretty active. And
that's F. Leroy...
1974, which gives away my age. So that's my Twitter account, and then I have my Google Scholar page where people can find publications. Now a lot of that is very technical, but some, maybe something people can explore as well. And well, that's about it. I think that's that's my main communication channel, Twitter, which okay. I find an amazing platform as well, because it really is one that stimulates much more so than things like Facebook. It really stimulates interaction and community building. So I'm just hoping and crossing my fingers that also there is not a tendency to monopolize certain visions, because we're seeing a lot of that lately on many social media platforms, that there is an interventionist approach to it that starts to erase certain voices, and I find that very concerning. Even though some voices may not be right, I think we should be very careful if we start restricting diversity. But then again, you probably have other platforms coming up to compensate for that. So
that's what I think, that there has to be this Hydra thing where there'll be a decentralized once it gets to the point where the censorship is so bad that the difficulty in setting up the decentralized nodes is suddenly a better prospect, then that will happen, you know? But I agree. For me, almost to the first approximation, Twitter is the internet. I remember when it first came out, I got an account and then didn't really get it. And then a few years later, I tried it again and I was like, oh my God, how did I miss how profound this is? And now I'm just a complete addict. Like Elon Musk says, we're cyborgs already, just limited by the baud rate of our thumb speed, which is pretty ridiculous and slow. But it's been great talking to you again. I really appreciate you coming back on, and you know, I look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.